Hello and welcome to the latest edition of RiskMap Podcast, looking into the first half of October 2015. I'm Michael Moran, New York-based Managing Director for Global Risk Analysis at the international risk consultancy Control Risks.
And in London, I'm Charles Hecker, Control Risks Global Head of Research. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, in this edition, we'll drop in on Washington's dysfunctional politics as the U.S. Congress once again is threatening to shut down its federal government. We'll look at Indian Prime Minister's plan to drop in on the powerful U.S. tech industry in Silicon Valley on his way to the U.N. General Assembly's opening in New York. And we begin with talks between two notoriously stubborn leaders who find themselves on opposite sides of many issues, Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu and Russian President Vladimir Putin.
That's right, Mike. Talks between the Israeli Prime Minister, who's visiting Moscow through September 27th, and his Russian counterpart, Mr. Putin, are the latest twist in Syria's civil war, which has entangled powers great and small. As the fighting rages on, allegiances and proxy relationships have been shifting, including the public stance of the United States and Russia. To explain the talks between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Putin, I spoke with Anna Walker, Associate Director for Europe. Anna, there are certainly friendly relations between Israel and Russia, but you don't see the Prime Minister in Moscow very often. This is his first trip to Russia for nearly 2 years. Why now?
I think the main concern is really about Russia's intentions in Syria. As we've seen, Russia is expanding its military capabilities in Syria, greatly enhanced its military involvement there. I think Israel is specifically concerned that Russia's intervention there, Russia's involvement there, will complicate the balance of forces in Syria with potential implications for, say, the transfer of weapons and arms to Iran and Hezbollah, which is obviously of particular concern to Israel.
Anna, there's been an awful lot of news lately about Russia's building an air base in Syria. Nobody seems to be able to understand what Russia's motives are in that country. Why an air base in Syria?
I think Russia's motives are really threefold. At the sort of tactical operational level, we believe it wants to use this airbase to protect its access to the port at Tartus. While this isn't really vital for the Russian military, it's nevertheless the last remaining such asset in the Mediterranean, and hence really symbolic in that sense. I think Russia is also very keen to avoid Assad from being overthrown in Syria. And this is not so much about support for Assad himself, Assad per se, but more about the concern at the potential for the implosion of Syria were Assad to be forced out. And of course, that has another implication for Russia in that it shares concerns about rising terrorism, the potential for returnees, for Chechen, Dagestani returnees for the conflicts in the region to come back to Russia and cause problems there. And then finally, sort of more strategically, it really wishes to remain a player and reassert its position in the Middle East, as has historically been the case.
Anna, on that very topic, there's a lot of conjecture about President Putin wanting to return to the table of big players in foreign policy. And we've seen reports of Russia building a new airbase in Belarus, very close to the border with Ukraine. Is this the signal of a start of a new aggressive phase in Russia's foreign policy?
It's more about Russia reinforcing its existing foreign policy messages and really reestablishing its key relationships. Belarus and Russia are, in theory, part of a union state, and this includes the mutual defense of their air borders. And by building this airbase, it's really reestablishing Belarus's reliance on Russia and sort of demonstrating that the two remain strategically aligned. It's obviously also, we don't think this signals any renewed intent to launch military action in Ukraine or any sort of invasion in that sense, but it really reinforces the message that Ukraine joining NATO or having closer relationships with NATO is very much a red line for Russia.
Anna Walker, thank you. Over there in America, Mike, it's deja vu all over again. That, of course, was one of the famous malapropisms of the famous U.S. baseball star Yogi Berra of the New York Yankees, who died on September 23rd. Yogi might have been referring to politics in Washington, where once again the threat of a government shutdown looms over social policy. Mike, about a year ago, you noted there was something of a truce in place that was meant to prevent this kind of situation. So what's happened?
Well, what happened, Chuck, is called presidential politics, and in this case, it's a particularly Republican version. As more than two dozen Republicans are trying to become their party's presidential candidate in 2016, cleavages inside the party over all sorts of things, and social policy, in this case, birth control and abortion, have exploded into the open. The Congress has to pass a bill every year by 1 October to authorize government spending. That's the fiscal year's beginning. chances that a full budget could be agreed by then are usually nil. So every year they do this thing called a stopgap spending bill. Some years, of course, the Republicans have held this process hostage. In 96, they shut down the government for 21 days under Bill Clinton. In 2013, Congress balked at funding federal agencies during the Obamacare debate, and national parks and all sorts of federal machinery shut down for 16 days. And Standard & Poor's later said that that cost $24 billion to the U.S. economy.
Forgive me, Mike, but this sounds a bit nuts. With Republican primaries starting in January, why would the Republicans want to shut down the government?
Well, it's a good point. And indeed, many Republicans in the leadership in both houses in Congress and many of the GOP's presidential hopefuls don't want to shut down. They know this plays into the Democrats' hands. But one man, a would-be presidential candidate named Ted Cruz, who's a Texas senator, is using the shutdown threat to demand that the U.S. cut off an annual grant of $500 million to a group called Planned Parenthood, which provides birth control and cancer screenings and family planning advice, including sometimes abortion referrals to U.S. women.
Mike, let's leave aside the ideological crusade. What are the chances the government grinds to a halt on the 1st of October, and what are the risks of that happening?
Well, in the last shutdown, which was also engineered by Cruz over Obamacare, some 1.3 million U.S. federal employees worked without pay for weeks, while another 850,000 workers and 250,000 contractors were furloughed. The pace of federal services that weren't actually shut down, like national parks and museums, for instance, are going to shut completely, but other services crawled to the halt. And that means like passport services, tax rebates, economic and statistical releases, federal courts, licensing, anything really that requires a central government is going to absolutely grind to a halt. And the military and the post office are an exception because they're funded separately, but it's a pretty disruptive event.
Mike, put your handicapping hat on. What are the odds of an actual shutdown?
Well, we are now seeing this as pretty likely. Cruz has no reason to back down. He wants to have his right-wing support solidified in the primaries. And the Democrats have already said that, in the words of one of their leaders, it's not our job to heal their divisions. And that's a bit cynical, of course, but the Democrats know they'll benefit politically. So a shutdown, maybe not a long one, but certainly a disruptive one, looks fairly likely.
Mike, consider me in wait-and-see mode. Thanks for that.
Well, that leads us to our final topic today, the visit of Narendra Modi to Silicon Valley. India's economy, of course, has boomed, at least in part due to the fertile exchange between the West Coast's IT and private equity capital and Indian cities like Bangalore and Hyderabad. I spoke to Control Risk's senior India analyst, Jan Zaleski, and asked what Modi hopes to gain from this visit.
Mike, there are actually many parallels with his visit to the U.S. a year ago, at least insofar as his schedule concerns. Just like last year, he's set to meet industry leaders. Just like last year, he will address the U.N. General Assembly. And just like last year, he will meet Obama in high-level talks. And he is also set to again address members of the highly influential and powerful U.S.-Indian community who gave him such a roaring welcome last year. The overall context, though, is quite different. Last year's visit came after a temporary downturn in relations, and Modi's primary intention arguably was to repair relations then and infuse a new sense of trust. And in that, he certainly succeeded. His charm offensive paved the way for deeper trade and security ties over the past year, even if at the time, no big ticket announcements in relation to investments were made. So this time around, relations are looking pretty good. And to capitalize on that, a key focus this time around will be on business. More specifically, on attracting investments to India and to lock in actual deals.
So it's much more about locking in deals now. What kinds of investment will he be targeting, and what will be his selling points and challenges as he tries to sell India as an investment destination?
Mike, IT and defense are likely to be the two standout sectors. India obviously has great strength in the IT field, which is also pretty open to foreign investments. So this is something of a natural sell. Unlike last year, Modi will this time also head to the West Coast to IT and tech companies in Silicon Valley, as you've mentioned, where he will spend a significant chunk of his time on this trip. In terms of defense, Modi will point out recent changes to FDI policies in India, in particular recent increases to FDI caps in the sector. However, this will be a much tougher sell than investments in the IT sector, primarily because foreign companies remain pretty concerned about some of the remaining restrictions that still persist in the sector and perceived shortcomings in India's commitment to protect intellectual property rights, among others. In the short term, Indian purchase orders in the sector are therefore more likely than decisions by foreign companies to actually shift defense manufacturing to India. More broadly, Modi's challenge will be to convince US lawmakers and investors that he can actually reform quickly enough. He's received praise for the reforms that he has undertaken so far, but those are perceived to be progressing not quickly enough. So although sentiment remains by and large positive, investors are increasingly concerned about Modi's gradual rather than radical approach to reforms. And many US investors specifically remain concerned about hurdles in India's broader business environment.
Well, Jan Zalewski in Singapore, thank you very much.
Mike, before we end, a few other notable events in the coming fortnight. On Saturday, the 26th of September, Mexicans will mark the first anniversary of the disappearance of 43 students in the state of Guerrero. Tensions remain high, and control risks seize the possibility of localized unrest. On Sunday, the 27th of September, Catalonia holds snap elections, a vote that is aimed at garnering support for the region's independence from the rest of Spain. Our Spain analyst expects a big yes vote, creating some complications for Spain's national government. On Monday, the 28th of September, the UN General Assembly opens its 70th general debate in New York. Raul Castro will speak there for the first time, and the meetings on the sidelines could hold particular intrigue. Pope Francis will address the gathering on the 29th of September. On Thursday, the 1st of October, a new Chinese food safety law goes into effect with harsher penalties for offenders.
Chuck, that's it for this edition of RiskMap Podcast, produced by Control Risks, the international business risk consultancy. Our podcast is released every other Friday on iTunes or via the Control Risks website, www.controlrisks.com. Also there, you will find our new white papers on cyber risk in Mexico's financial sector and India's growing automobile industry. For now, on behalf of my colleagues in 36 offices around the world, this is Michael Moran in New York saying goodbye.
And in London, I'm Charles Hecker. Thanks very much for listening, and until next time, so long.